The lecture I wish to give today, I've titled Palestinian Geography in the Time of Christ, in the time of our Savior, going back almost 2,000 years ago. I'm going to talk about Palestine. And when I say Palestine, I mean not just necessarily the land of Israel, primarily that, but the adjacent lands that are associated with it. The whole area in which the environment of Christ was found, and that of the apostles as well. Now, some might wonder if the study of Palestinian geography is important at all. Well, let me tell you, it certainly is. If an individual wishes to come to an adequate understanding of biblical teachings, especially history and prophecy, but I might even say doctrine, Palestinian geography is very important indeed. There are three main historical factors which help us to understand the past. Number one are the records of the events themselves. I mean, this event happened. This person, these people, this nation, that nation, all were doing these things, all right? These are events. Events are very important. But number two, you've got to have a chronology in which to place those events if you're going to understand the past. That is, you've got to know the time. It would be kind of silly, wouldn't it, to talk about Columbus discovering America and he was met on the shores by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I mean, most school children would understand that doesn't fit. You've got to get the proper chronology in mind. And in our new book, The Birth of Christ Recalculated, one of the major factors is the chronological factor, which has been misunderstood up to now. But number three is the one I'm going to talk about today, and it's a very important factor of understanding history in the Bible, and that is geography. You've got to know where those events took place. You've got to know where the army was that fought with this other army, or you're liable to get into great difficulty. And I might say, and I mentioned just a moment ago, on prophecy, that is very important, because we have certain prophetical interpreters today that will take events prophesied for the future at a particular time. They may get the time generally correct. They may get the events generally correct. I say they may. But you know what they do? They take the nations or the peoples out of the areas where the Bible says they will be, and they place them in Europe or America or someplace else. And no wonder they get utterly confused over the whole issue. Geography is very, very important if we're going to understand history. And the Bible, by the way, is history. And I could say this, that even the comprehension of doctrine in the New Testament, particularly in the Gospels, is very importantly, geography is very important to it. And I hope to bring out one or two illustrations of that, perhaps in this lecture. Now, what was Palestine like in the time of Christ? Some of you have been with me to Israel and the Middle East on some of the trips that I've taken down there. We're planning one again in 1980. Information will be in it in the next commentary. That is the December issue of the Commentator. You might be interested in going. I would say this, that those who have seen the Palestine of today and the cities of Palestine are amazed in some cases at the backwardness that they see. Not the modern Palestine of Tel Aviv or Haifa or places like that, which is very similar to our cities here. But when they see the old cities, like the old city of Jerusalem or Hebron or even Nazareth, they are in some cases appalled at what we might call the backwardness. Associated with these old cities are very pungent scents that you can get going through the marketplaces of all different types. Some of them are very pleasant, some are a little unpleasant. You see the camels, you see the donkeys, you see the barters, the traders, all these ancient types of things, at least ancient as we consider them to be. However, Jerusalem itself, I just might mention this at the outset, even the old city of Jerusalem that you see when you go down there today within the walls of the old city, you'd be surprised to find that that is not so ancient after all. The walls were built in the 16th century, the early part of the 16th century, by a Turk by the name of Solomon the Magnificent. And many or most of the buildings in old Jerusalem have been constructed since that time. And do you know there is not a single building left that was in existence at the time of Christ in Jerusalem? There's not even a building left from the middle of the 2nd century A.D. The oldest buildings that we have, or you can see, in Jerusalem are those which were built or started to be built in about the 3rd and certainly the 4th century A.D. Now that comes to 300 and some years after the time of Christ. So the Jerusalem, or the cities of Hebron, places like that that you see, have buildings in them which were not even there in the time of Christ, with some very few exceptions. So when a person looks at Palestine today, he looks at those older cities and he imagines that's the way it was in the time of Christ. That is not true. It is true, however, that there were camels around. They were beasts of burden. It is true that there were donkeys. It is true that there were Bedouins on the peripheral areas of Palestine, which were mainly desert. It is true that the cities didn't have lights like we have today, and or running water like we have. In some cases, some of them did. It's true on those factors. But when a person really understands the Palestine in which Christ lived and preached, it's totally different than what most people imagine today. Now, I have this book here by, it's a translation of Josephus, The Jewish War, by G.A. Williamson. It's a very interesting book, but in his introduction, Williamson translated the works of Josephus. Now, I think we understand that Josephus was the Jewish historian who lived in the time of the apostles and later. He was an eyewitness to the Jerusalem before the destruction of the temple and the city of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. He was born in 37 A.D., so he was a young man before the Jewish war took place, and he was a general in that war to start out with. So he knows Palestine very well. And here is this translation of Williamson, and in the introduction, it's most interesting what he says. He's talking about how Josephus describes Palestine back at that time, the time of Christ and the apostles. We have some remarkable descriptions of many of the geographical features of Palestine. And a great deal of space is given up in Josephus to bringing before our eyes the cities, palaces, and temples which filled this little land with beauty and made it one of the greatest creations of Hellenism, as different as could be imagined from the Palestine of our Sunday school memories. Unquote. Williamson is right. As different as could be imagined from what we've been taught in Sunday school, Sabbath school, and in most books. He says it was one of the greatest creations of Hellenism. What is Hellenism? I've been giving some lectures of late on the development of religion in the Middle East. Hellenism is a term associated with the ancient Greeks. And in actual fact, if you would have gone back and seen many of the cities in Palestine, including Jerusalem itself, in the time of Christ, you would have thought in most cases you were in Greece or in areas of Greek influence. You would have seen beautiful buildings made out of, in some cases, marble, some most cases of the local stone, white limestone of the region there. Lots of gold in some cases around, but beautiful Corinthian columns, buildings that look so much like you would imagine Greece to be today. And that's what he means, and it's an actual fact. Most of these buildings have all disappeared. We have just mere remnants of them left. But I think I'll make a statement at the very beginning here. And it's absolutely true that if all of the buildings, even in a ruined state, mind you, if the ruins would have been left in Palestine, instead of being carted away because they were so good to be used elsewhere, if they would not have been carted away but left in Palestine after the major wars of destruction that took place in 70 A.D., 135 A.D., and other times, people would probably be going to Palestine to see the noble examples of Hellenistic architecture in the world today, and it's a fact. But it's been scraped clean practically because it was so good. The architecture there, or the buildings, were so good that even in a ruined state, we have absolute records in Josephus where the Romans and others came in and carted away whole segments of cities, ruined cities, and took them to other places, because why carve out stones from a quarry when you've got all the things you need right there? All you have to do is to transport them to another area. And it's a fact. It's been shown that some of the areas of Lebanon, very beautiful area up there, some regions, some cities, the Temple of Baalbek, for example, constructed probably in the 2nd century A.D., many of the stones that made that beautiful temple, which is still in existence to this very day, I've seen it, you can go over there and see it, were made by stones that came from Palestine, and it has been stated that some of them came from the temple at Jerusalem. It's most remarkable. Palestine today has been denuded. In actual fact, Josephus makes it quite clear that the Romans in 70 A.D. denuded the whole area around Jerusalem, stripped it of every tree within 10 miles of the city center. Every single tree, not a scrub was left. Now you can imagine what would happen to an economy that was beautiful all around at the time, but then every single tree, he makes an emphasis on that, every single tree was cut down within a 10-mile radius of Jerusalem. And that was just one war. The city of Jerusalem was destroyed to such an extent that the records say, people who are eyewitnesses, you would not have believed there was once a city here. Now, what did our Lord say was going to happen? He said all those stones are going to be torn down and only bare remnants have been left. That's quite true. In Mark 13, there's one other statement I want to make in the introduction here. Williamson says that this story of Palestine, of the time back there in the time of Christ, it is a tale of a country filled with such a wealth of architectural and artistic splendor as has perhaps never been seen elsewhere since the world began, and reduced by crimes and follies to a desert, a mass of shapeless ruins. Now, that statement there is from a scholar who's been to Palestine, but he's translated Josephus. And people who have been with me to Palestine, been on the hills of Judea and Samaria, they are awestruck sometime at the desolation that they see, especially on the slopes of the hills. And they wonder, is this the Palestine in which our Lord preached? Well, there's been a lot of reforestation and things like that taking place, both by the Arabs and by the Jews. That's quite true. And a lot of the country in certain areas is beginning to take on a more beautiful aspect. That's quite true. But I'll tell you, whole sections of the country today are still in the position that the wars left them in back in the past. It's been reduced, as Williamson said, by crimes and follies to a desert, a mass of shapeless ruins. But in the time of Christ, it wasn't that way really at all. In the Olivet Prophecy, here was Christ on the east side of Jerusalem, on the highest mountain overlooking Jerusalem to the east. He was standing on the Mount of Olives 2 days before his crucifixion, and that's when he gave his Olivet Prophecy. The whole prophecy was initiated or inspired primarily because the apostles, while they were up there on that Mount of Olives and looking across the Garden of Gethsemane up to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem to the west, they were awestruck by the beauty of the buildings. And here's what Christ says. Well, the indication of this is in Mark chapter 13. It's also in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. But the description in Mark 13 is very, very good. Verse 1, "And as he," that's Christ, "went out of the temple, one of his disciples said unto him, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here." There are still some remnants of the stones of the wall around the temple, not the temple itself. Every vestige has gone of the temple, but the wall around the temple, 1,600 feet on one side, 1,600 feet here, about a quarter of a mile on each side. It takes about a mile to get around the walls of the temple. Some of those big stones are still there. One of the largest is on the southwest angle. I can still see it in my mind's eye. It happens to be about 6 feet tall. It's about 4 feet thick, as I recall, or is it five, something like that. It's about an arm stretch like this, and it's 60 feet long. 60 feet long. One stone carved, absolutely rectangular, perfect in every way. They've estimated that it weighs 60 tons. That's just one stone. And there are all types of other stones that made up this beautiful, marvelous wall that is was still, the remnants of it, the base of it is still there, that housed the temple. The temple itself is gone. It's no wonder that one of the disciples said to him, "Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here." It wasn't only the stones, it was the buildings associated with it. They were beautiful beyond compare. The temple was called in contemporary records back at that time one of the wonders of the world. In fact, the most magnificent building that was on the surface of the earth at that time, and even the Romans recognized it, was the temple at Jerusalem built by King Herod, the one in which Christ preached. It was magnificent beyond compare. I'll give you a description of it, an eyewitness account in just a few minutes. Most remarkable. "Look at these manner of stones and what buildings are here. And Jesus answered and said unto him, Seest thou these great buildings? There shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. He sat upon the Mount of Olives over against the temple on the east part. Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately, Tell us, when shall these things be? That is, when will the tearing down of the temple of Jerusalem, the destruction of these buildings, be? And also one other point, what shall be the sign when all these things shall be fulfilled? And it says in Luke and in Matthew, the sign of your coming and the end of the age. You have to put it all together to get the full discourse there. And then he starts off with the Olivet prophecy, which you're familiar with. Well, I don't want to go into that. But you know, that temple was glorious beyond compare. Let me read you just very briefly here. I don't want to spend too much time on this. But just very briefly, an eyewitness account, that is of Josephus himself, of the general aspect of the temple. It is most remarkable. It's on page 394 here of Williamson's work. He says, viewed from without the temple, the sanctuary, it had everything that could amaze either mind or eyes. Overlaid all around were stout plates of gold. In the first rays of the sun, it reflected so fierce a blaze of fire that those who endeavored to look at it were forced to turn away as if they had looked straight at the sun. Just imagine a building, and this was a huge building. As I said, it a quarter of a mile by a quarter of a mile by a quarter of a mile, quarter of a mile. That's the walls that surrounded it, and overlaid by gold. You can imagine that on the top of it, in many cases. And when they would look at this, with the sun beginning to shine on it, if it came into a right position, it would just blaze in glory. Not only that, to strangers, as they approached the temple, seemed that it was like a mountain covered with snow, for not one part was the part not covered with gold was dazzling white, made out of the white limestone of Palestine. That stone over there has been burnt now by the sun after 2,000 years of the sun shining down on it. It's not white anymore like it used to be. But you can still see remnants, or you can see new stones cut out of some of the quarries there, and they are resplendently white, just beautiful. It goes on to say that Josephus said, if you got up on Mount Scopus, which is the northern extension of the Mount of Olives, where the disciples were, and you look at the temple in the distance, just about a mile away, it did look like a snow mountain, a mountain of white snow with gold on top, like it was just blazing in the sun when the sun would come out. Like a volcano, you know, you might say, or something like that. Now, that's quite a description. It's no wonder those apostles were saying, look what goodly stones and buildings there are here. There is a reconstruction of that temple, as best as understood, in Jerusalem. And it's really something to see, even that. It was magnificent beyond compare. And they had associated with it a fort called Antonia, which was a four buildings in actual fact, towers, in which the soldiers would stay, that they could swoop down very quickly if there were any disturbances in the temple. It was a fort built like a town. It had hot and cold running water. It had all types of lavatory facilities, I mean, for waste, everything. It had huge banquet halls. It had everything in it associated with the temple. And when the Apostle Paul was apprehended in the temple, he finally was walking up the steps into the Antonia. And there's when he began to talk in Hebrew to the crowds, and they began to listen to him. All of that is very well documented here in Josephus, where those things were. And by the way, this temple was surrounded by these walls, and there was a colonnade on all sections of the temple that people could walk under to keep them shaded from the sun. Four columns wide. Josephus shows those columns in here. In fact, we have remnants of them. There were just about 1,000 columns supporting the colonnade around this temple area. And Josephus said each column was so big that it took three men holding hands this way, linking their arms together to get one of the columns. And there were 1,000 of them. Plus on top of that, on the south part, there was another area down there which was supported by also about 250 columns. And if you got to the southeast angle, Josephus said if you looked down, the height was so far down that it was dizzy to look at it. And very, very difficult. That was called the pinnacle. And that's where Christ was taken by Satan the devil when he was told to throw yourself down, you know, and the angels will bear you up and you won't stumble your foot. All these things are very well documented, and they're there, and some of the remnants of these ancient ruins are still in the area. But you know, when I was in St. Peter's at Vatican, just the last time I was there, which I guess was 2 years ago now, I went to the Vatican and St. Peter's Square specifically, this time with this in mind, to look at the columns that support the great square of the Constitution there. And in the center they have the obelisk. And it's a very beautiful display, it really is. But you know, it took to get around one of those columns just about three men to get around it. But I think don't quote me on this, I think I counted 250 some columns supporting that grand area of in St. Peter's Square there, which is probably the biggest in the world today, you know, from that point of view. And yet there were 1,000 of them supporting the area around the temple that of Christ would see. Most marvelous. People don't realize these things, but it's absolutely a fact. Let's go on here. The whole region there was very rich at the time. In fact, I think what I should do is just primarily call your attention to some of the descriptions here by Josephus without going into it at length. But he does say here on page 75 of Williamson's work about the building of the great temple by Herod, about the construction of Jerusalem with all types of buildings. He said that the temple was magnificent beyond compare. And no doubt that was true. He talks about the fortress that was associated with it, which was a palace itself. And then Herod built his own palace in the upper city, just to the west of the temple. It consisted of two very large and very lovely buildings, which made even the sanctuary seem insignificant. And he named the two buildings after two of his friends. But this was it was not only in buildings alone that Herod enshrined his memory. This is the time of Christ. He had such lavish generosity upon the land that whole cities came into being. Whole cities, and that's a fact. In the district of Samaria, that's north of Jerusalem, about 35 miles or 40, he built a city with magnificent walls over 2 miles long, and he settled it with 6,000 colonists. He allotted to them some land of excellent heart, and the center of the new town, he erected a vast shrine, a temple with precincts dedicated to Caesar Augustus, 3 yards in length. Most of us who have been down to Palestine have seen the remnants of that. And you look at it today and you say, well, there's nothing much there. But let me tell you, at the time it was built, can you imagine a brand new city built for 6,000 colonists and is made out of the finest type of construction material that you could get? In fact, he said the shrine was of white marble dedicated to Augustus. At Jericho, he built palace buildings. He goes on and on and on. In fact, I cannot think of a suitable spot in his kingdom that he left without some tribute of esteem to Caesar Augustus. This is Herod the Great. When he had filled his own country with temples, that is Palestine. These tributes overflowed into his province, and into city after city he erected a caesareum, that means a temple to Augustus Caesar. And it was always on Greek style. Now here's a most interesting thing, and I must mention this. You've all heard of the city of Caesarea, mentioned in Acts chapter 10. A very famous man of the Bible lived in Caesarea. His name was Cornelius. He was a centurion of the Italian band. The Apostle Paul, well, I should say Peter in this case, went to him and preached Christ to him, and he and his family were baptized and converted. You'll remember it in Acts chapter 10. Do you know, this Caesarea, all of that happened about, what, 45, 40 A.D., something like that, maybe 10 or 12 years after Christ's crucifixion. I mean, I'm talking about the incident with Cornelius. But you know, that city had only been there about 50 years or 60. It was built brand new from scratch on the coast of Palestine. And the interesting thing about it is that Herod, when he wanted to build something, he wanted to have a memory left after he died of all the buildings that he was able to build. And they were very great indeed, not only buildings but cities. I'm drawing, for all of you who are listening on tape, an outline map here of Palestine. Here's the coastline line right here, and it curves down toward Egypt. All of you who are listening on the tape, all you have to do is to get a map in the back of your Bibles of Palestine. You'll see the coastline there and how it curves westward toward Egypt. You can see the Sea of Galilee up in the north, and the River Jordan comes out of the Sea of Galilee and finally down into the Dead Sea. And there's the River Jordan that even flows into the Sea of Galilee up in the north there. But over here on the coast, which is presently about 40 miles north of Tel Aviv, it's about 40 miles, Herod decided he wanted to build a brand new port city, a city that had never been, a new city that had never been built before. It's, Josephus says, he noticed on the coast a small town called Stratos Tower. Now, it was a small little town in a state of decay. But thanks to its admirable situation, capable of benefiting by his generosity, he rebuilt it entirely with limestone and adorned it with a most splendid palace. Going on to say here, it took him 12 years to build this brand new city, and he named it after Augustus. He called it Caesarea. It was built here on the coast. It was to provide a port city to Jerusalem, to Samaria, and to Galilee. And that's when it came into existence, just before the time of Christ. The king, by lavish expenditure and unshakable determination, won the battle against nature and constructed a harbor bigger than that of Piraeus, which was the harbor of Athens, noted for its largeness and goodness. And he further made deep recesses into the sea to make it navigable. Now, the interesting thing about this Caesarea here is, though it was a very propitious site as far as location was concerned, to go to Jerusalem, to go to Samaria, to go to Galilee, his engineers told him it was the worst place in the world to build a port city because of the sands that keep coming in and out and things like that. They said it's better to build it somewhere else. They suggested quite a number of other places. And he said, which is the best, though, as far as geography is concerned, of the country? And they said, well, that is. But it's the worst place to build a city because of shifting sands and things like that? That's right. He said, that's where I want it built. That was the type of attitude he had. He wanted to overcome all nature, if he could possibly do it, and to get glory in it. Well, he built the city. And the description of this city, it took 12 years to build, and how they built it in only 12 years is beyond me, because it was well over 3 miles or 4 square miles in area, with a great wall around it, with an aqueduct coming from the Carmel Mountains of about 30 miles down to it to bring water to it. The ruins that you can see, though there are not many of them left, are absolutely magnificent. The harbor that was built, he wanted to make it bigger than the harbor at Piraeus. So what he did was to construct an artificial harbor going out this way and around this way, and he made an opening for ships on the north western segment. This harbor went out, I mean the breakwater, went out a little over a mile, I believe he says. He was finally putting down stones, large stones, to make this breakwater possible, into 20 fathoms of water. Now, how large or how deep is a fathom? About 6 feet, isn't it? 6 feet. 20 times 6, 120 feet he went down into the ocean. I mean, he went out, but he's finally finding himself 120 feet deep of water, and he's building up blocks. Can you imagine how they did this back in the time just before Christ? The blocks, or the stones, he says, some of them mostly were 50 feet long, 9 feet deep, and 10 feet broad. Now, that's what Josephus says. Remnants of this have been found by some Italian archaeologists. They haven't been able to find exactly all that Josephus said, but the harbor was most magnificent. Now, can you imagine when they finally got out about a mile, not quite, but almost, building this breakwater, going down into 120 feet of water? That is a 12-story building high. And they're putting the blocks down there, and they built it up. Not only when they got it built up, they then made it 200 feet wide. And on the 200, all the way around, and then he put various buildings on this breakwater where the ships coming in, if they were bringing hides, for example, from the Crimean area of the Black Sea, they came to a particular spot. If they were bringing grain from Egypt, they would come to a particular spot. All types of commodities were there, but they had to come to certain areas on the breakwater, and that's where they would dock. And ships were coming in and coming out. Not only that, to make it very grand and to make sure that people would be able to see it as they approached it from the sea, he built, I'm not quoting this here, well, I could do it, but time is fleeting. He built two huge statues, one on one side and one on the other. They were quite tall, and at the top of them, he put lights, that is, burning with oil, so there'd be lighthouses and people would be able to see from a distance of 20 or 30 miles out in the ocean which way to get to the port. It says in the Bible several times that Paul and others came to Caesarea. They passed through this magnificent area here, and that's where Cornelius himself lived. And you know, it was a city of amazing beauty. In fact, in the center of the city, he built a temple to Caesar, a grand temple. It was of exceptional size and beauty, said Josephus. It was, and in it he placed a colossal statue of Caesar Augustus, no whit inferior to the Olympian Zeus, which it was intended to resemble. You know what the Olympian Zeus was? Considered one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. The Olympian Zeus, which was in Greece, was a statue so large that everybody looked at it with just awestruck. It was 40 feet high seated. We have no remnants of that left. But here was a colossal statue, this time of Augustus Caesar, in the midst of this brand new city in his temple, that rivaled the Olympian Zeus. It must have been a gigantic affair. Now, Cornelius would have seen that. Paul would have seen it. Everybody would have seen it. But you know, this is just one city that he built. He built quite a number of them. He built one near Jericho. He built Antipatris, which is not very far from Caesarea. He built the one of Samaria that I said before. But in fact, it just goes on and on and on of what he built. And it mentions the cities. And then he builds castles of his own, Herod did, all over the place. And he mentions about the Herodium. If any of you ever go with me down to the area, you can look south of Jerusalem, about 10 miles near Bethlehem, and you see a mountain that comes up like a volcano. And people have noticed how it's conical shaped. And it sticks up above all the other mountains of the Judean hills, Judean mountains. And you can see it very well from the Mount of Olives. On the top of that, he built a huge castle. He built three of these, by the way, but that's the one near Jerusalem, about 10 miles south. The interesting thing is that that mountain that sticks up there is all artificial. He had his slaves and others build up the mountain, and on the top of it, he built this huge castle. In fact, Josephus says it was entirely artificial, and he made a castle on top of the whitest marble. After this spate of building, he mentions all these things, he extended his generosity, Herod did, to a great many cities outside his own boundaries. I'm bringing this out to show how rich the country was. It wasn't like we think at all today. Very rich. For Tripoli, that's up in Lebanon today, Damascus, Ptolemais, he provided gymnasia. In other words, he built buildings for them. For Byblus, which is up north, he built a wall. For Beirut and Tyre, he built halls, colonnades, temples, and marketplaces. Now, this is out of his own country. For Sidon and Damascus, he built theaters. For the coastal city of Laodicea, near Antioch, he built an aqueduct. For Ascalon, that's down here in the Philistine country, for Ascalon, he built baths, magnificent fountains, cloistered quadrangles, remarkable for both scale and craftsmanship. In other places, he dedicated woods and parks. He loved to make parks. I know lots of people who like to make parks nowadays, and maybe have their names described after them, and so forth. Herod the Great was very, very similar in that desire. Many towns, if they belonged to his kingdom, received gifts of land. Others he endowed with revenues to finance for all time the annual appointments of a gymnasiarch, which is dealing with games and things like that. And corn, wheat, he bestowed on all who needed it. To Rhodes, the island of Rhodes, which is up near Greece, he over and over again gave money for naval construction. And when the temple of Apollo was burnt down, he rebuilt it with new splendor out of his own purse. I'm talking about Herod the Great, just before the time of Christ. If we understand this is just before the time of Christ, before it was all destroyed, you can see that our Lord was preaching in a very magnificent area. Now listen to this. What need be said for his gifts to Lycia and Samos, that's Asia Minor, or of his liberality to the whole of Ionia, that's Greece, sufficient for the needs of every locality. Now listen to this. Even Athens and Sparta, most of us have heard of those cities, Nicopolis and Mysian Pergamon are full of Herod's offerings, are they not? That's what Josephus says. And the wide street in Syrian Antioch, that's where the Christians were first called Christians, Syrian Antioch. That's where Paul had his headquarters. That's way up north. The wide street in Syrian Antioch, once avoided because of the mud when it rained, did he not pave 2.25 miles of it with polished marble? And to keep the rain off, he furnished it with an overhead colonnade from end to end. Now, that was in Syrian Antioch. Let's go on. It may be suggested that all these benefits were enjoyed only by the particular community favored. But his endowment of Elis, that's in Greece, was a gift not only to Greece in general, but to every corner of the civilized world, reached by the fame of the Olympic Games. Have you ever heard of the Olympic Games? They're supposed to have been started in 776 BC. There's some dispute over that exact date, but let's say that's the case. Well, we are familiar with the Olympic Games. The last were held about 4 years ago, and the Winter Olympics, I understand, are going to be held in Lake Placid here in the United States, New York State. And then we're going to have the Olympic Games in the summertime, 1980. Well, you might be surprised, but listen to this. The Olympic Games were going at that time, too, in Greece. Talking about the Olympic Games, it says, seeing that the games were declining for lack of funds and that the sole relic of ancient Greece was slipping away, he not only acted as president of the four-yearly meeting held when he happened to be on his way to Rome, but he endowed the Olympic Games for all time with an income big enough to ensure that his presidency would never be forgotten. Did you know that Herod the Great was president of the Olympic Games? Well, it's been forgotten, hasn't it? But now it's reminded again. Josephus says, we should go on forever. Of course, he's exaggerating here. If we tried to list the debts and dues he paid for others, as when he relieved, he named several places here, of their annual taxation even. All of this came from King Herod. Now, I could go on and on in his description of Galilee, which he said was most prolific country. Beautiful, trees all over the place. That is where Christ was reared, as we know. He mentioned Samaria, the central region between Galilee and Judea. And he mentioned Judea too. And he said it was noted for its cattle and the lush lands that were around and the grass that was everywhere. He mentions that. In fact, even in the Gospel of John, John chapter 6 and verse 10, up here on the east coast of the Sea of Galilee, Christ fed the 5,000, it says, because there was much grass there that they could sit on. I can take you to the Golden Heights today and you're not going to find any grass to sit on. It is most remarkable. That whole country, however, and I'm going to sum up very quickly here now, that whole country was far different than you and I would imagine it to be. And here we are approaching the Christmas season now. And normally on Christmas cards, you see three wise men, and we don't know if there were three or 12 or how many, but approaching Jerusalem. And they're usually in the traditional garb that we're familiar with today on camels. Who said they came on camels? They may have. Who said they are in the traditional garb of today, which is an invention from certain Arabic sections coming up no later than 600 or 700 years ago? They didn't look like that at all. Now, I don't object to the scenes from that point of view, but what this does is to cloud the whole picture of what it was really like. And the problem is that we today, people today, look upon the Palestine of Christ's time as being barbaric, being primitive, and coming of the true religion of Christianity was coming out of a very decadent and backward region of the world. That is not true. I could go on for another four lectures at least, just giving information primarily from Josephus and other sources to show that that little land was one of the most splendiferous, if I can use that word, that you can possibly imagine. And as G.A. Williamson has said in his introduction to the Jewish War, it was a land which was absolutely beautiful, as different as can be imagined from our Sunday school memories. But because of crimes against mankind and against God himself, that land has been reduced practically to desert and a mass of ruins. And it's no wonder that the wars and all that took place to reduce the vegetation of the land practically to nothing. And then even after others came back and tried to raise new crops or new trees and things like that, most of the people had to go later on into what you would call a shepherding type of existence. Have you ever heard what happens to a land when you put goats indiscriminately on the land? Sheep are not so bad, I understand, but they're pretty bad. But put those little old cute goats on them, thousands of them, over the Judean and the Ephraim hills, let the little sprigs of grass begin to come up, or trees or whatever it is, and they snip them off. It's been stated by quite a number of ecologists that the problem of Palestine in the past 300 to 400 years have been goats more than people, to be quite honest with you. It's no wonder that we have a land today that is reviving. That is quite true. And God says that even the deserts will blossom in the future, and Jerusalem is going to be great, and so will Palestine.